The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purposes of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these televised proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Oral questions put by members to ministers will now start. It is 12:41 and we will finish at 1:41. The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for the Premier. In last year's throne speech, the government said, I quote, "We must also deal with the looming labour shortage. Nova Scotia is the first province in Canada to have more seniors than youth. Soon, more people will be leaving the labour workforce and entering it. That simply cannot be allowed to happen. We need skilled workers, we need healthy and safe workplaces, and we need innovative thinking," end of quote. Mr. Speaker, my question to the Premier, how can Nova Scotians have a skilled workforce when funding cuts to school boards are taking place?
Honourable the Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, as I've said to the Leader of the Opposition in the past, in fact, the per-pupil funding for students in our province this year is up, and in fact, the overall education budget is up as well.
The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition on your first supplementary.
Speaker, the budget just passed shows that funding to public education is going down in the province of Nova Scotia, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the Premier has also said, and I quote, "Past governments did not see this coming, or they thought the workforce problem would somehow take care of itself. My government promised to educate and train. Training would be the answer to the impending workforce shortage," end of quote. Mr. Speaker, university tuition is going up 3% across the province. Professional programs and international students are hearing of increases from 6%, 10%, and 14%. My question to the Premier, how does the Premier expect to address Nova Scotia's workforce shortage by limiting access to university?
Honourable the Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, we're doing the opposite. I would just go back and correct the member opposite. He knows that in addition to what he has said, that the number of students in our schools is also declining, so that the amount of money per student that is being spent in the public school education is actually going up, Mr. Speaker. That means more support for students in the classroom. In addition, Mr. Speaker, students who are going to universities and to community colleges now are able to take advantage of the graduate retention rebate. They will be able to take advantage of the debt cap that we have created, the new support for students, Mr. Speaker. In addition to that, Mr. Speaker, we have put in an additional $30 million to support students in our universities and community colleges.
The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition on your final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the spirit of correcting, Mr. Speaker, what I said here was that there was a cut in funding to public education, Mr. Speaker, and I think if the Premier reads his own budget, he'll understand that is actually true, Mr. Speaker. It's quite simply, the Premier doesn't have a plan for public education, Mr. Speaker. As a matter of fact, he contracted that out. And before hearing from Ben Levin, the person that the province had contracted out to build a plan on how we go forward in public education, they decided to cut core funding to education, Mr. Speaker. The Premier has cut teachers, literacy programs, math programs, supports for the most vulnerable youth, teaching assistance, library supports, university funding, and a university disability specialist, Mr. Speaker, and the list goes on. So my question to the Premier, will the Premier tell this House why he is slashing education programs before telling us what education outcomes he believes our school system should be providing?
Honourable the Premier.
Well, again, Mr. Speaker, This is simply not true. The reality is that the per pupil funding is actually going up. When the number of students that are in our public schools declines, Mr. Speaker, obviously that has effects on the number of teachers that are required and other in other areas. But, Mr. Speaker, this government does not make those decisions. We give the money to the school boards. They decide on their priorities.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party.
Mr. Speaker, last year, after a very lengthy review and much debate, the government announced its support for the Convention Centre project in Halifax. Since then, many deadlines, developer deadlines, have come and gone. Now we're waiting for the federal government to do its review. The Premier had indicated that we needed to go through an election before the federal government could respond, and here we are today. And so my question through you, sir, to the Premier is this. Will his government today reaffirm their support for the Convention Centre project and share with us when he will take that support to Ottawa to get that job done?
Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, nothing has changed with respect to the government's support for this project. What I can indicate is we have had a very good relationship with Mr. McKay. There is one thing that we will have to wait for, though. I believe that the federal government will have to appoint their cabinet in order to be able to understand exactly who is going to be in charge of which portfolios, and we will have to wait until that is done.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, the Premier may be content to wait for yet some other event before he gets going, but 60% of Nova Scotians have already indicated their support for this project. As per the CRA poll that I tabled in this House a few weeks ago, it is good to know that the government continues to support this project, the NDP government here, but the key missing element remains the lack of support by the NDP members of Parliament for our area. And so my question to the Premier is this. Will he address that key missing piece by communicating directly with his members of Parliament from this area, the support that his government has, and get them engaged in bringing this important project to Halifax?
The Honourable the Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm tempted to say that the polls are closed now, so we're not just waiting for some other event. This is not waiting for some mystical thing to happen down the road. You literally have to wait until the federal government appoints a cabinet. Somebody has to have charge of the file. Somebody has to be empowered on behalf of the federal crown to make the decision. We're just going to wait until that is done.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party on your final supplementary.
Here, the Premier, in his first answer, said bragged about his great relationship with the federal minister for our province. Secondly, he says they'll have to wait to see who's going to be in the cabinet from Nova Scotia. There is no need to wait, Mr. Speaker. This is an important project. Yesterday's event was exactly what we were waiting for to get over with so we could get on with the job of bringing that project home to Nova Scotians. But, Mr. Speaker, it is not at any cost. Will the Premier assure this House that his government will express their support, but it will not be funded at the expense of other projects like our highways and roads funding, Mr. Speaker?
Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, the federal government has control over the envelopes of funding. Last year, we had one of the most prodigious road paving budgets in the history of the province. Mr. Speaker, I anticipate that the federal government will have their own priorities. Of course, we'll be working with them to ensure that what happens is in the best interest of the entire province. And I look forward to the opportunity to continue to work with Mr. McKay if it turns out he continues to be the federal minister in Nova Scotia. Whichever other MPs are involved in those decisions, we'll work with them. Mr. Speaker, but I intend to work with all of the MPs in Nova Scotia, elected from any of the parties. We are simply advancing the interests of the province of Nova Scotia, and I will work with anybody to get that done.
The Honourable Member for Richmond.
Mr. Speaker, this NDP government has eliminated bail supervision and has cut funding for 15 ankle bracelets used for electronic monitoring of offenders. Mr. Speaker, both initiatives were meant to help ensure offenders respected the conditions of their court-imposed restrictions. At the same time, bail supervision and ankle bracelets allowed police officers to focus on making our streets safe and fighting crime. But due to the cut in funding to the tune of $322,000 for these programs, the responsibility for bail supervision, house arrest, and probation will now fall to our overworked police officers. Now, my question to the Minister of Justice is, has his department done an analysis on the police resources which will have to be diverted away from investigation and crime prevention in order to pick up the slack left by this NDP cut?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you to the member for the question. As I stated in the estimates that where he draws his details from, is that this government has maintained the Officer on the Street program and has not cut a cent from theirs to date. We also have... in regards to the bracelets, we're very confident that the present system is working and that it will continue to work, and that the police, if there's an incident comes up, will respond in accordance.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, the whole idea behind having probation officers following up on bail, probation and house arrest was in order to remove that as a responsibility for the police so that they could focus on fighting crime and making our streets safer. This government has now decided, at a time when we're seeing increasingly violent crime in our province, that they should cut that funding and put that burden now on our police officers rather than being on the streets trying to prevent crime from taking place. So my question to the minister is, can he tell Nova Scotians how many hours will police now have to spend checking up on offenders who were previously supervised by probation officers?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Well, Mr. Speaker, in regards to the bail supervision, what's interesting about that program is that it was underutilized, and we were spending money and putting money into a program that wasn't reaching its capacity, and therefore dollars are being rediverted to be to work smarter and wiser, and so that there's limited dollars. We have to be prudent in how we spend them, but we have to be effective in how we spend them, and that's the difference between this side and his side of the fence.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on your final supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the Minister has said you do the crime, you do the time, but his actions speak louder than words, and when we see the Minister of Justice turn around and cut funding, which would have alleviated some of the pressures on police officers, he's certainly sending the wrong message. The idea behind having the ankle bracelets and probation officers check up on offenders is to make sure that they are honoring the court-imposed restrictions that are placed on them. To now have that burden being turned onto police officers means that instead of fighting crime and making our streets safer, police officers are now going to have to accept that extra responsibility. So my final question to the minister is, how can you explain how putting this extra burden on police officers is going to make our streets safer and prevent crime from taking place in Nova Scotia?
Order, please. I'd like to remind all honourable members who are recognized by the chair that they must direct all comments and questions through the chair, and using the word you is unparliamentary. So I will ask the member to rephrase the question and any other questions they may ask later. Thank you.
My question to the minister is, how can his government justify putting added responsibilities on our police officers at a time when there's increasing violence in our province?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What's interesting here is some of the words that my colleague has used. He's using the word assumption, and we know when we break that word down what it could end up saying. On the word, he's also creating an atmosphere of fear rather than logic. He's not placing in it. He makes the assumption that the police are not able to do their job or that this is overburdening. We have examined the situation. The Nova Scotia taxpayer wants us to spend their money wisely. We're putting the money in a more prudent way. And as I said earlier, we haven't cut the officers on the street. We've enhanced the delivery of service in this province by our investments. And, Mr. Speaker, I'm very pleased with the way that we're approaching this issue.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on a new question.
Mr. Mr. Speaker, this NDP government has gone through great lengths in this spring session in attempting to block the official opposition's efforts to examine the Department of Justice's budget. Now, Mr. Speaker, now we know why. Speaker, the Minister of Justice has supplied us with data which shows a 55% cut to crime prevention programs for the next fiscal year. This NDP government has decided that this would be a good time in Nova Scotia to cut $475,000 from crime prevention initiatives to make our streets safer. Now, my question to the Minister, with the recent surge in violent crime, murders, gun violence, and a rash of stabbings, why would the Minister cut crime prevention by 55%?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And once again, and it seems to be a consistent pattern of the opposition, they don't get their facts straight. They take pieces of information out and they run with it. It would be really nice if we could get a question that was based or had a foundation to it and had some principle behind it. The accusation that the member makes there is that we cut 55% from our budget is the furthest from the truth. What was cut was from restorative justice, for example, some issues where they had a grandfather clause. Is he suggesting that we continue with programs that are to come to an end and invest new money? We need to look at more creative ways of how we invest our money and spend it wisely. I would really appreciate if he could get his facts straight.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on your first supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'd be happy to provide this to the Ministers. Department of Justice reductions approved by Treasury Board fiscal 2011-2012 advice to the Minister of Justice, where it says reduce grants, discretionary, crime prevention, restorative justice, reduction of $475,000, program budget, $857,000. Percent of reduction, 55.4%. I'm wondering if the Minister could tell us what's not true about exactly what I read there from your own piece of paper that you provided in estimates.
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Mr. Speaker, this government has not cut the core funding to crime prevention. And in fact, I want to just share, in speaking with crime prevention is my focal point. And to share with him in regards, I spoke to an officer the other day. We have a conference that's here from people from all across Canada here this week in the city. He's more than welcome to drop in. In fact, I'm giving a speech Thursday night. He could listen to that and get and see where we're going to from. And Mr. Speaker, in regards to that matter, is that the police officer shared with me, this is the first time that he knows in his career where we have a government that believes in working in a collaborative manner, bringing stakeholders together and putting forth our focus on dealing with the root causes of crime and moving those issues forward. So, Mr. Speaker, I stand on that comment.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, the minister himself has indicated that his government cut $475,000 from crime prevention initiatives. It's there in his budget. He's the one who supplied us with that information. A 55% cut. So, Speaker, this is going to be a cut to some of the programs which the minister announced on March 31st, 2010, with funding for community programs, where he said, empowering our youth and community partners is one of the key ways to developing safe and healthy communities in Nova Scotia. So, Speaker, the minister keeps telling us about a strategy and a plan. Unfortunately, it appears to only exist in his head because he's refused to share it with Nova Scotians and share it with members of this House. So my question again is, when will this government finally present an anti-crime strategy to deal with the growing rate of violent crime here in Nova Scotia?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you very much. I just want to just read a couple of little things that the discretionary spending is $200,000, which is remaining in the budget. The Department of Justice has invested approximately $240,000 into our lighthouse programs that deal with youth, deal with specific issues into the community. This is also further funding that goes to the Uniform Law Conference, the Sexual Assault Project, Law Reform Commission, judicial institutions, some police events, and other types of things that we're investing in, such as the Crime Prevention Conference that's happening here this week. One time, Mr. Speaker, what the difficulty is at being on this side of the fence and trying to explain to some people that have a closed mind is that if something comes to an end, if it's a grandfather, but if he's suggesting that the taxpayer of Nova Scotia just write blank checks for things that might come in the future, I said, I'd rather be on this side making the decisions in the best interest of the province.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, a moment ago I asked the Premier about the Convention Centre, and he seems content to wait for his protocol office to give him permission to write to Ottawa and stand up for this project for Nova Scotians, while no one else in the country is waiting to get their list of priorities in to the newly elected government. So I'll try again, Mr. Speaker. I'll try again on another urgent, important matter facing Nova Scotia, and that is the issue of immigration, Mr. Speaker. Last Friday, the government announced their new immigration strategy after 2 years of waiting. One of the things that they correctly identified as an issue that Nova Scotia faces is the cap on the number of provincial nominees that we can bring into our province every year. My question to the Premier is this. This is not a new problem. This is a two-year-old cap. And so my question to the Premier is, what has his government actually done, other than complain about it, in the last 2 years to try and lift that cap so we can get going on immigration?
The Honourable the Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the very first thing we did was last year, for the first time, we actually hit the cap. The very first time that the cap became relevant was when we hit it, Mr. Speaker. So, Mr. Speaker, of course, we're going to deal with the federal government as immediately as we can to demonstrate what we have said in our strategy. It is about 10 o'clock the day after in Alberta, so I'm not sure I can get him on the line, but we'll give it a try.
Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party, on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, everyone agrees that the cap is too low at $500 a year for a province of 940,000 people. To brag about hitting that cap is like bragging about batting 100 in the major leagues. The Premier is expected to do better than that. Now that we do have a new national stable four-year majority government in place, my question to the Premier is this. What is he going to do in the next 6 months to make sure that we get that cap lifted?
Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, it's amazing. The leader of the Conservative Party sits there with a group of people, those that are left, who couldn't hit a cap of 500, Mr. Speaker, let alone any more. This government is committed to a comprehensive immigration strategy. We intend to prosecute it with full vigor and ensure that we meet not only the cap targets, but we're going to use all the other streams to ensure we bring more immigrants to our province.
The Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party, on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, the member opposite has been the Premier for 2 years now. He has had lots of opportunity to work on this file. He's promised it three times, and only on Friday did they produce their strategy, and still we're wondering what has been going on over there to deal with this issue for the last 2 years. Now, Mr. Speaker, we have another problem related to immigration, and that is that our greatest single hope for immigration in the future, our universities, are charging a 10% increase in their fee to international students. I know this Premier and this government loves to charge more in fees, and so my question to the Premier is this. Does he agree with that increase in fees for international students? And if so, how does that jive with his own immigration strategy?
It doesn't at all.
Honourable the Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I can tell the leader of the Conservative Party that I have been very active on this file. I have met, in fact, with agents who deal with international students from many parts of the country who come to Canada. What they tell me is this is not a question of the ability to pay of those students who are coming to Canada. That's not the issue. The issue for most of them is whether or not they can get a visa. The problem is if they need a visa to go to a university in the United States, they can get one in 2 or 3 days. In Canada, it takes months to be able to get a student visa to get into the country. So if there is a problem for international students, it resides with the federal government.
That's right.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, just like user fees and HST and not addressing bracket creep, power rates are going up. And so my question is for the Minister of Energy. You know, when the member for Cole Harbour was in opposition, he said, These increases will make life less affordable for every family in the province, and these increases will affect jobs as Nova Scotia industries struggle to remain competitive. He was right then, but the same applies now, and yet the NDP seem willing to sit back and allow Nova Scotia Power to seek its seventh rate increase in 10 years, and they seem willing to defer to the Utility and Review Board on whether it should happen, which is not at all what the NDP said in opposition. In fact, the member for Fairview at the time said, "It's hard for Nova Scotians to accept. I think their power rates are being set by a few big players in the system." Well, Mr. Speaker, we agree with that as well. So, Mr. Speaker, will the Minister of Energy state now in the legislature today that he will oppose the planned rate increases by Nova Scotia Power?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And I thank the Honourable Member for the question. Yes, we're all concerned about electricity rates, and we know it's a basic necessity of life here in our province, and we're, as a government, of doing a number of things. Certainly many energy efficiency programs are being implemented at this time, where we're pursuing a number of renewables to take away from the expensive cost of coal, to bring the price of electricity down. And of course, this government brought the 8% tax off of electricity to make it easier for consumers in this province.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, it's almost laughable that this government thinks that it can continue to use taking the HST off electricity as a savings when they added 2% to pay for it on almost every other item that people pay for. It's just disingenuous, and they added another tax to electricity. Mr. Speaker, it just doesn't make any sense. And just like the Premier said in opposition when he said increases like this will force many families out of their homes so they can no longer afford to heat. He was right then, and it's right now. And the fact of the matter is this government has increased the price of almost everything in this province. So, Mr. Speaker, the NDP government is doing nothing to stand up to this monopoly, and they pass the buck constantly. It's a regulated monopoly. The NDP does not have to sit back and say their hands are tied. The government chooses to sit back and say their hands are tied. Mr. Speaker, will the minister order a performance audit of the operations of Nova Scotia Power prior to any planned rate hike?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And we as a province are working long and hard with Nova Scotia Power to, we've asked them to look at their bottom line to see if there's any cost savings or any energy or any efficiencies there to reduce the rate that they're asking for. And again, and we're looking at renewables, we're looking at energy efficiency. We've taken the HST off of electricity. It would be good now if the federal government would do the same. That would take a 5% reduction off of power bills for Nova Scotians.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, they started in the past couple weeks deferring to the URB, which they opposed in opposition. Now they're deferring to the federal government to solve the problems. I mean, what is this? This crowd over here in opposition, this crowd in opposition said that it was up to the government to do something every single time Nova Scotia Power went for a rate increase, and now they want the URB to solve the problems for them. So, Mr. Speaker, would the Minister of Energy kindly tell me what has changed in the NDP policy so drastically since it became government that, in fact, that now they believe that it's up to the URB to do it and not government? And in fact, to quote another member of the government, why should we trust you now?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This government has some of the most aggressive renewable targets anywhere on this continent. 40% renewables in electricity by the year 2020. And so we're doing something about it. We're looking at all the possible sources of renewables, and we will be working eventually to bring down rates for Nova Scotians. And through the energy efficiency program, there's a prudent investment there on the power bills that in the end will make less expensive for power in this province.
The Honourable Member for Bedford Birch Cove.
Mr. Speaker, when asked about education cuts last week, the Premier said, and I quote, "We haven't cut anything, nothing." Will the Premier please explain why, then, formula grants to school boards decreased by nearly $20 million?
The Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, I realize this is very, very difficult to understand. But when the number of students go down, the funding goes down, but in this particular case, Mr. Speaker, the per pupil funding, the actual amount of money per student has increased. I hope that clarifies it for the member.
The Honourable Member for Bedford Birch Cove on your first supplementary.
So in fact, what we've done is cut funding to school boards, despite the fact that the Premier said we haven't cut anything, nothing. And in fact, I will table the part of the budget that indicates that we did in fact cut the school board, monies to the school boards. Mr. Speaker, the Premier also said we've taken expensive programs, thrown them out, and brought in new programming that meets the needs of students. Yet after hearing of recent budget cuts, the President of the Nova Scotia School Boards Association, Vic Fleury, said, and I quote, "The challenge will be to do more with less." Can the Premier please explain why the Chair of the Nova Scotia School Boards Association is concerned about cuts when the Premier claims there haven't been any?
Honourable the Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I assume that the Chair of the Nova Scotia School Board Association is doing their job. Of course, they want to try and protect their budget, no matter how much the decline in the number of students goes down. They're going to still want to have the same amount of money. I don't think that most Nova Scotians think that's a reasonable position for the school boards to take, Mr. Speaker. The budgets of the boards have gone up dramatically, while almost 30,000 students have come out of the system. Obviously, Mr. Speaker, the amount of money supplied has to address the demand that is there. I believe that that is a position that the majority of the vast majority of Nova Scotians would agree with.
The Honourable Member for Bedford Birch Cove on your final supplementary.
So, Mr. Speaker, the Premier says there have been no cuts, but when we look in the budget, we see the number goes down. Ergo, there have been cuts. Mr. Speaker, the government refuses to take responsibility for massive cuts to our school system. It was the NDP government's decision to cut reading recovery, not the school boards. It was the NDP government's decision to cut math and literacy mentors, not the school boards. How can this Premier say his government has cut nothing when, in fact, these cuts have been directed by the Department of Education?
Honourable the Premier.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Look, this is an extraordinarily serious subject, and I think it deserves an appropriate response, because the reality of the world that we live in is that we have a shrinking demand among the number of students who are in the schools of Nova Scotia. What that means, Mr. Speaker, is that the amount of money that we are putting into the classrooms per student is going up, Mr. Speaker, not going down. It is up to the boards to make the decisions with respect to program delivery with the money that we give them.
The Honourable Member for Argyle.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I think on Thursday I started off with a question about the tobacco strategy, and I'll start again so we see if we can get to the end of it this time. Last week, the Department of Health finally unveiled its new tobacco control strategy, and anything with the goal of reducing smoking in Nova Scotia is a positive step forward. However, I was disappointed to see the document announced as just another expensive piece of literature, like the new gaming strategy, the new agricultural strategy, and many other strategies that this government has introduced. Considering this document is just a recycled, updated version of what our government produced in 2001, Mr. Speaker, my question through you is, why did it take the government 2 years to introduce the new tobacco control strategy?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I was very pleased to announce our tobacco strategy last week, and I was very pleased to get the endorsement of various groups such as the Cancer Society of Nova Scotia and Smoke Free Nova Scotia, as well as the district health authorities, for the direction of that strategy, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Argyle on your first supplementary.
Thank you so much, Mr. Speaker. There was a 10% reduction in smoking rates between 2000 and 2006, but this was achieved through smart legislation, a balanced tax approach, and public awareness. In this new strategy, the government has set some lofty goals for reducing smoking rates amongst teens and adults, but it doesn't include any indication of new legislation, tax increases, fines, or increased enforcement officers. So, Mr. Speaker, my first supplementary through you to the minister is, what tangible actions will be taken in order to reach these targets?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, as you very well know, this is year one of the strategy. And Mr. Speaker, we have been focused on we've been focused on youth, Mr. Speaker. And we have underway a social marketing campaign. The artifacts and the dinosaur have been traveling the province, Mr. Speaker. And they've been very well received, Mr. Speaker. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Argyle.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. All I can say to that answer, because there was a little bit in there, is that I do hope that the Flyers do win the next game, just to get us over that hump. Mr. Speaker, raising taxes on tobacco can be a deterrent for purchasing tobacco products, but it also can lead to increase in the black market for such products. So, Mr. Speaker, my question through you to the Minister of Health and Wellness, is the government planning to raise taxes on tobacco products anytime throughout the duration of the strategy?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, one of the provisions in the Financial Measures Act that passed second reading here yesterday, I believe, will allow a stamp to be placed on packaging to help us with the fight against contraband. Tobacco. The strategy is a complex strategy. It looks at a variety of measures that we will use to fight and combat the use of tobacco. And certainly we are always very interested in looking at the kinds of measures, such as taxation of tobacco products, that can contribute to a reduction in rates of smoking in the province. But it's a very comprehensive strategy. It has many elements, and there are still areas within the strategy that allow us to consult and to develop other measures over the course of the strategy, which is a 5-year strategy.
The Honourable Member for Bedford Birch Cove.
Mr. Speaker, yesterday it was reported that Cape Breton University will raise tuition by 3%, joining a list of universities that will be forced to raise tuition fees this September. The president of Cape Breton University Student Union, Billy Crowley, spoke out against the CBU tuition hike. He said, "The goal of our institution has to be to make education accessible to each and every student that wants to go to university. When you increase tuition, you're already starting to limit that window. When you increase tuition, that means less students are going to be able to afford to go to any universities. My question for the Minister of Advanced Education, do you agree with Billy Crawley's remarks that increasing tuition will limit the window to post-secondary education?"
The Honourable Minister for Labour and Advanced Education.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Certainly I agree that that capping tuition increases is just one of a number of different initiatives that this government has taken to protect access to post-secondary education in this province. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Bedford Birch Cove on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, Billy Crowley also said, "We're extremely disappointed by the lack of attention the government gives to what they call the future. They will often say that university students, college students, and high school graduates are, of course, the future of our country, and yet Nova Scotia has some of the highest tuition in all of Canada. The The government says it wants to keep young people in this province. It claims to be preparing for a shortage of workers, of young workers. We've already seen increases of up to 14% for other university programs. My question to the minister, how is increasing tuitions by 3 to 14% for many programs part of a strategy to attract and retain young people and immigrants?
The Honourable Minister of Labour and Advanced Education.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Certainly, making post-secondary education accessible to not only young Nova Scotians and mature Nova Scotians, but also people from elsewhere in Canada and around the world is very important, because a significant number of people who attend university in Nova Scotia stay behind to start their careers and raise their families. We have been a significant player in making sure that average university tuition for Nova Scotia students has come down below the national tuition average. We're very, very proud of that, and we have taken many measures to protect that rating. We have to take a balanced point of view. We've invested as a government well over $40 million this year to protect access to post-secondary university education. We take this very, very seriously, and we have not only continue the bursary, we've put a debt cap on, we have done we've improved the student assistance package. I would think that most Nova Scotians feel that we have certainly done due diligence in terms of supporting this sector. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Bedford Birch Cove, on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, apparently the students wouldn't agree. We now know that fees for international students are increasing. We've already heard reports of some international students looking elsewhere for their education. These are the very people the Premier said we want to keep in Nova Scotia to help with immigration. Mr. Speaker, how does allowing tuition fees to increase and not capping international student differentials support attempts to increase immigration to Nova Scotia?
The Honourable Minister of Labour and Advanced Education.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Certainly, we recognize the importance of both attracting international students and encourage them to stay and, as I said, start their careers and their families in Nova Scotia. What we did, we actually capped international tuition fees at 3% for this year. But certainly universities are able to present a business case as to why the cost of delivering that program may require an exemption to that. Whether or not there's going to be a cap in future years will be part of our negotiations with the universities during the current memorandum of understanding process. We value international students, but at the same time, we recognize that Nova Scotians can only afford to pay so much towards university education. So we're trying to take a careful balance where we protect both interests. Thank you. Very good
answer. The Honourable Member for Richmond.
Mr. Speaker, I want to raise some concerns regarding the government's new immigration strategy. It's come to our attention, we've heard that the government soon, very soon, intends to increase red tape on small businesses who have no other option but to access temporary foreign workers in order to fill positions they have not been able to fill locally. It's come to our attention that small businesses will soon have to register every individual temporary foreign worker they employ, resulting in clearly more paperwork for these small business owners. I'm wondering if the Premier could explain why his government is creating more red tape for small businesses that use temporary foreign workers.
Honourable the Premier.
Actually, Mr. Speaker, the opposite is true. We're just concluding an agreement with the federal government that will actually streamline access to temporary foreign workers.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, my question was very specific as to whether the government was going to require small business owners to register every temporary foreign worker that works for their enterprise. Clearly, this is a concern about more red tape on small businesses at a time when all governments are trying to reduce the burden. So my question again, will the Premier confirm, yes or no, whether his government is going to require small businesses to register every individual temporary foreign worker that is employed by them?
Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, when a worker comes here to work, it is necessary for the businesses who employ them, in course, to register who they are. That's about accountability and oversight, Mr. Speaker. So the answer for the question is yes. But on balance, what we are doing is we are signing an agreement with the federal government to streamline all of the requirements that are necessary for businesses to get foreign workers. So, on balance, Mr. Speaker, it will be much easier process for businesses.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, the concerns raised with us as small business owners don't see this being any easier at all. They, in fact, see it being a bigger burden on them to have to formally register with the government every individual temporary foreign worker, as they have been told that as part of the strategy there will be some follow-up by the Department of Immigration with these specific workers. The concerns are that this is going to require more staff from the government to process all of these registrations. As well, the fear is that the government will put some type of user fee on them in registering these individual temporary foreign workers. So will the Premier confirm today whether there will have to be any staff increases as a result of this, or whether small business owners will face any fees in registering every individual temporary foreign worker that they employ?
Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, employers routinely account for the employees that they have in their business. This is not something new. In fact, it's part of the responsibility of being an employer. So, Mr. Speaker, what I can tell them is that there is a bill that is coming in relation to this, and the details will be revealed soon, very soon.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton West.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, my question through you will be to the Minister of Education. Mr. Speaker, this past week, a number of junior and senior high schools within the Cape Breton-Victoria Regional School Board were informed that funding for the community liaison officers would be cut. Mr. Speaker, these easily accessible police officers are in our schools. We're mentors and leaders for the students facing online bullying, mental health concerns, substance abuse, family instability. Also last week, we learned that the youth pathways and transition programs for at-risk students will be eliminated at the end of June. Mr. Speaker, my question through you to the minister. What is this minister doing to support at-risk youth and the safety of our students in our schools?
The Honourable Minister of Education.
Well, thank you very much. And our government has the safety concerns of our students foremost in our minds. And so, but to answer the question that the Honourable Member raises, he has brought forward some information that I wasn't aware of, so I will need to do some investigation. But I do know about the liaison officer situation. I've been just informed that the funding for the liaison officers, which do an absolute tremendous job all across our province, the work that they do within our school system, that actually they were being paid for by the school board, where every other school board in the province, that is paid for by the community, the municipality, the police service themselves. So we need to investigate this a bit further, but I would just say that the service does provide a valuable service, but the funding for this, it's very interesting that the funding has come through the school board for the liaison officer. That's an anomaly. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton West.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker.
On your first supplementary.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And again, to the minister, this is $158,000 that we're talking about. It is also money that is spent by the regional police services in Cape Breton. It has been shared in the past by the school board. Mr. Speaker, the minister said in the Herald last week, and I quote, "The bottom line is that the children in the classroom, their education will be protected." Well, Mr. Speaker, in Cape Breton, there are 62 teacher layoffs, 50 TA cuts, math mentor cuts, reading recovery cuts, and now the community liaison cuts. And the parents are worried about their children's future. Mr. Speaker, my question to you, to the minister, is how will the department ensure that the students' education and their safety is protected?
The Honourable Minister of Education.
Thank you very much. I just want to say that not only is safety of a concern with the school liaison officers do a much broader job within our school system, and so I really value the work that they do. And I will be working with asking, there is a department member, Constable Mark Smith, I think his name is. I'm going to ask him to look into this situation. But safety is of our highest priority, and we will be working with the Cape Breton School Board around this issue. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton West on your final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I want to thank the Minister for that answer. I'm looking forward to her working with the Department. But Mr. Speaker, QPE Nova Scotia President Danny Kavanagh said last week in a release, and I quote, "The provincial government wanted any cuts to take place at the level of consultants and senior administration. The six-figure salaries that seem to have ballooned in our school board system over the last several years." End of quote. In a question period on April 21st, the minister said, "I trust that the impact will not be felt by the students in the classrooms." Mr. Speaker, my question through you is to the minister is, what is the department going to do to ensure the school boards are cutting in the areas of administration and not frontline services for our students?
The Honourable Minister of Education.
Thank you very much. I'd like to make a correction. It was Constable Mark Young, not Constable Mark Smith. We are going to make sure that the children of our province have the appropriate education in each and every classroom across Nova Scotia. The school boards were mandated to look at reductions in administration and also within consultants and in the school boards. Unfortunately, we have a situation, especially in the Cape Breton area, where we have declining enrollments, and we are making sure that the funds that were made available to the school boards match the children that are enrolled in our school system. Unfortunately, I think it's 700 students are leaving Cape Breton Regional School Board this year. It might be a higher number, but I know we've lost over 2,500 students from our system this year. We are making sure that the money that we have provided the school boards is going to meet the needs of the children that are in our classrooms. The mandate is that they have to protect the children in our schools, and they are going to receive the education that they need and the education that they deserve. Thank you.
Member for Dartmouth East.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for the Minister of Energy. Mr. Speaker, we've been talking about the issue of fracking in this legislature for quite a while now. And now the government did move one small step and said they would begin a study. However, the government still refuses to put a moratorium on new fracking permits until that review is complete. Now, in the past couple of weeks, moratoriums have been put in place while studies are done in South Africa. There was already one in Quebec. One been put in place in Arkansas, parts of New York, parts of Pennsylvania, parts of Texas, and the list goes on. Most of those within the past couple weeks. So I can't fathom why Nova Scotian agrees there is merit in doing a study, but apparently is one of the only jurisdictions doing a study but won't put a moratorium in place at the same time. So, Mr. Speaker, in light of growing concerns on this issue, will the minister now agree to place a moratorium on new fracking applications until the study is complete?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And, you know, we certainly want to assure Nova Scotians that we're going to protect their environment. And the last thing certainly we want to see is any damage to the environment or any harm to drinking water. And that's exactly why we've undertaken this review. And it will look at the impacts on drinking water, on the environment, on soil and the landscape. Drilling practices and so on. And actually, we're asking Nova Scotians to come up with what they feel should be included in the scope. So it's open till the 6th of June. We'd love to hear from Nova Scotians on what they feel is most important that we do study. And but at this time, there are no applications for drilling or hydraulic fracturing, and we don't anticipate any during the period of our review.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East on your first supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. You know, the minister keeps repeating that there's no fracking applications are expected, and yet during repeated questioning and estimates, he refused to say what he would do if an application was received. So last week, Petroworth, who's doing some work in Lake Ainslie, was asked about this by the media, and they publicly, in their public comments, refused to rule out fracking this summer in the Lake Ainslie area. Now, the government has a two-year legacy of not releasing reports on time, so whether this one will come on time, who knows? Last week, the South African cabinet handled this issue of whether to have a moratorium, even though they expected no permits. And they said, despite there being little chance of an application, a moratorium was warranted. So, Mr. Speaker, when almost every other jurisdiction doing a study on fracking regulations appears to be putting a moratorium in place, why does the minister think Nova Scotia should be different?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And again, as I mentioned, we have no applications at this time. These applications do take time to go through the processes. The Petroworth application is before the Department of Environment, Department of Energy, and at this point has not been approved. And but they're all individually judged, and there's a lot of details that have to be looked at in an application. And again, we're not going to approve any application for approval unless we're absolutely assured that it's safe, the environment's protected, drinking water is protected. And again, I can assure you that we feel confident that no applications will be coming forward during the period of this review.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East on your final supplementary.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I'm sure that the residents in the Lake Ainslie area will be interested to know that that application is now before government, at least for drilling work. You know, the minister was dragged to the table to do a study, and yet he doesn't seem to want to change anything. In fact, the minister won't even allow the study that he talks about to be independent of government officials who have already shared their view with residents that fracking is safe. Mr. Speaker, in Alberta last week, we saw a $30 million lawsuit filed over the issue of fracking. So, Mr. Speaker, in light of growing concerns, not only in Nova Scotia, but in Texas, South Africa, and all over North America and around the world, will the minister now ensure that the study is done independent of his government officials?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. And we're trying to get the science right here. We're trying to get the facts. We're trying to get the best possible information, and we're looking at best practices in other jurisdictions. Again, we're inviting Nova Scotians to ask what they feel should be included in the scope. And we really have the best of both worlds here. We have our technical experts in the Department of the Environment and the Department of Energy, but we're also calling for any technical expertise outside of government that we will require. So in the end, we'll get the very best practices that will apply to Nova Scotia, and residents will have that opportunity to have input again on the regulations before they become finalized.
The Honourable Member for Kings West.
Speaker, Mr. Speaker, on April 29, 2010, government announced a new act to manage and develop the fur industry in Nova Scotia. This was an excellent initiative, Mr. Speaker, and one that we support. But it's been nearly a year, and we're still waiting on the regulations for this important industry. Producers want the regulations so they can operate their farms properly within government guidelines. My question for the Minister of Agriculture, when will Nova Scotians see regulations for the fur industry?
The Honourable Minister of Agriculture.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the member opposite for the question. I have to say, I'm certainly hoping that before the end of the month of June, that we'll have regulations for the province ready.
The Honourable Member for Kings West on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, Nova Scotia is a major mink producer in Canada. Government has been late on countless reports, Mr. Speaker, and are taking their time again on regulations for an industry now worth about $100 million annually. Farmers need the guidelines from the province, and citizens want strict rules around how mink farms are operated. My question to the minister, what organizations did you consult with, and how many public meetings did you hold for concerned citizens on this matter?
The Honourable Minister of Agriculture.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I can get that number for the member, and I want to make it clear to the member and to all members of the House. When we introduced the legislation last year, my staff told me we would be 3 years getting the regulations, and I told them no, we would not. We would be a year, and that the community that has an interest in this wanted to participate in the drafting of the regulations, and I made a commitment that they would be involved. To this point, there have been a couple of meetings, but not of any consequence, I'll say. The staff is drafting those regulations, and when they have a draft, then we're going to take it to the community for them to have a look and have some input into those regulations.
Kings West on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, we know representatives from the fur industry have been helping government develop the regulations along with interested stakeholders. But, Mr. Speaker, the information does not seem to be reaching to people concerned about mink farms in the area. My question to the Minister, what is government doing to alleviate the concerns about the industry practices?
The Honourable Minister of Agriculture.
Yeah, certainly I know both Department of Environment and Department of Agriculture, Mr. Speaker, have been in touch with the community. This government, and I believe that no government would stand by and allow the environment to be polluted by anybody. And until we have those regulations drafted so that the industry knows what it is that they're supposed to be doing, the community can rest assured that certainly with the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Environment, we have no intention to allow anybody's environment to be compromised by any industrial or farming incidents that might possibly occur, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Victoria the Lakes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, my question through you is to the Minister of Economic and Rural Development and Tourism. Mr. Speaker, tourism in Victoria County is one of the main drivers of the economy.
Order, order, please. The time allotted for oral questions put by members to ministers has expired.
This podcast was previously aired on Legislative Television. The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purposes of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these televised proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.